Welcome to Intergalactic Relations, a University of Sussex podcast. On this season's podcast, we explore the liberal utopianism of Star Trek: The Next Generation. From the profound optimism of early seasons, mirroring the optimism at the end of the Cold War, to the pessimism that creeps into the show a few years later, as the inhuman results of shock therapy in the former Soviet Union and US misadventure in Somalia showed the limits of that post-Cold War order. We hope you'll learn a little about Star Trek and a little about international relations. Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Faiz Sheikh, lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex. I am a big fan of Star Trek: The Next Generation, but I cannot watch Star Trek: Picard without inducing vomiting. With me are my co-hosts, Dr. Sarah Bulmer, senior lecturer in politics and international relations at the University of Exeter. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Faiz. And what you just said about Picard is like totally outrageous, but we can cover that later.
And Dr. Dan Watson, consultant researcher on civil wars and peace building. Hi, Dan.
Hello. And you are right about Picard. Got your back, man.
For this episode of the podcast, we watched season 2, episode 9 of The Next Generation. The episode is called The Measure of a Man, and it is essentially a courtroom drama. There are a few external shots of the ship, but otherwise there is not a lot of trekking in this Star Trek. It's inside a room, and it's discussions of law, of philosophy, of what separates human from machine. And we're dealing with one of the characters who is an android, Mr. Data, and a crazed scientist who wants to disassemble him at the risk of Data's life. The question being, does he have a life? And is it a problem for this scientist to potentially disassemble him and not be able to put him back together again? And that's more or less the episode. Sarah, I saw in your notes for this episode that you had something to say about the opening scene and the poker game. Maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
So the scene, it opens where some of the senior crew are playing poker and Data is there. And Data has, of course, learned all the rules and everything there is to know about poker. He's even got the little cap on. He's fully sort of trying to perform this poker player role. And of course, he doesn't really understand bluffing. And he loses, and he doesn't understand why he loses. And the doctor, Polanski, says it's because of human instinct. And so that sets up the whole sort of theme of the episode, which is what is it that makes us human or makes us a sentient being? And can Data ever attain that?
Yeah, this is from season 2. And I have to confess, I'd actually never seen this episode until we started doing this series, because season 2 doesn't have a great reputation. It was a writer's strike when it was filmed. They sort of dredged up a bunch of disused scripts from an abortive show called Star Trek Phase 1. I'd swerved away from this episode, but I actually quite liked it.
Was it Phase 1 or Phase 2?
I think it was Phase 1, I think, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't want to be attacked by the Star Trek nerds out there.
Yes, God forbid. There's some hardcore people. Well, I would say I also like two of the side characters in it. There's one who's the JAG, the Judge Advocate General, Philippa Lavoie, and she is sort of this quite kind of strong character who is sort of presented as a bit officious, but also like an old flame for Picard.
Yeah, I like the idea of romantic Picard. It rarely comes up in the show.
Yeah, and the other character, the sort of mad scientist Maddox, he's not your kind of like zany mad scientist type. He's more your sort of sociopath type. And he's really something.
Excellent. Okay, great. So first we're going to discuss the episode. Then we're going to try and apply some international relations analysis to the issues that we identify. And finally, we'll think about what the episode can tell us about the liberal utopia of the show. So, lots to discuss. What were our issues or points of discussion that we want to raise in this episode? I want to start, and I want to talk about this awful exchange that Picard has with Philippa at the beginning and then again at the end of the episode. It really tops and tails the whole thing, where they're clearly, as Dan said, are old, you know, they're old flames. They have this prior relationship and they're kind of, they're flirting, I think, or something. And she says, she's got this wonderful line, "It brings a sense of order and stability to my universe to know you're still a pompous ass and a damn sexy man." Picard looks really uncomfortable with this. He does not know what to do with...
He's basically being sexually harassed, though, isn't he? In the workplace. I mean, that's what's happening there.
He is. That does make sense. Mr. Law and Order. Yeah, she probably broke a few regulations right there. He should be reporting her to HR. I see. Who wants to go next?
I mean, I can talk a bit about the character of Philippa. So for me, Philippa Lavoie is just like the classic epitome of post-feminism from the early 1990s. She's, and you know, post-feminism was really about the cultural representation of women after feminism had apparently done its work. And then we've got, you know, the rise of Ladakh culture, the ideas about autonomy and agency that women have, and that there was a lot of ambiguous representations of women. And so what you've got with Philippa is someone who is sexually confident. She is all about reason. She's all about ambition. She's going to do her job. She clearly already prosecuted Picard in a previous court martial, I think it was. And so you've got this career woman who is basically sort of sexually harassing him. And Picard's actually the one against her who's the one who's emotional and sensitive and, you know, overreacting. And again, I find this really interesting, the way that it's upsetting and disrupting all our heteronormative kind of ideas in a quite provocative way.
And he's a man scorned as well. Like, he has not let it go that she tried to prosecute him.
He's got fragile masculinity. He really does have fragile masculinity in this. These exchanges.
But she insists that he buy her dinner. And that, to me, that confuses me with regards to the post-feminism angle. And I think you can make sense of it for me, Sarah. Like, isn't that really...
Well, no, but she's demanding it. And that was the thing about post-feminism, is that it was about these contradictory representations of the status of a woman and the status of femininity. And so she's demanding that. But of course, yes, it's this idea that a man is paying for dinner, but he's not. He's not offering. She's demanding.
I see.
Also, who buys dinner in a world without money?
That's, yes, we should flag that in this depiction of humanity's future, there is no money, right? There's no currency.
You basically just go to a replicator and press a button and you get dinner. So, I mean, it wouldn't be that generous if you did offer to buy a dinner, because just walking up to a replicator...
It's true.
It's basically luxury communism, like Aaron Bastani's book, Fully Automated Luxury Communism, but with a massively militaristic kind of edge going on. That's how I would conceptualize the Starfleet universe.
Oh, nice. And we'll come back to the militarization of Starfleet, I think, in the next episode, where they come up against the Borg, but the spoilers. Great. Dan, how about you?
Yeah, I think one of the things that kind of leaps out at me with this episode is... So some of the depictions, I guess, of like neurodiversity. You mentioned earlier, Fires, the ways in which like Data, and it's quite almost a revival of Spock from the 1960s show. And there's quite a lot of cliches in how they're depicted. A bit of a kind of an awkward outsider sort of fumbling their way through. And there's a really good film producer and YouTuber called Jesse Gender who engages a lot with kind of with science fiction. So one of the things that she's spoken of with this is the tendency for these characters to kind of internalize others' perceptions of them as being deficient outsiders in some kind of way. And I think you can kind of see that in Commander Data, who right at the end asks, like, this is something along the lines of, like, please continue teaching me to how to be a better human, rather than sort of having that self-worth and saying, no, I'm different, and that's okay, or even a good thing. Like, not please teach me to be independent. It's like, please teach me to be more like you so I can fit in a bit better. And I also think it's quite interesting in, this is more in the show more broadly, both Spock as well as Data, they are some of the most overworked crew members in terms of the number of functions that they have to do and the number of like different things that they fill in. If there's ever a complex problem, they're like, Spock, come over here. Data, pick this up, this really heavy thing up, because he's got superhuman strength.
No, let me correct you. Picard describes it as mega strength. Which I know.
My apologies, man. He has mega strength.
I've got two more things, and please, you know, just jump in if you've got more as well. Guinan. We haven't talked about Guinan. She is played by Whoopi Goldberg, who, if you're not aware, she, in some part, credits Star Trek for getting her into acting because she saw Nichelle Nichols, another black woman, on TV during the 60s. And she turns to her mum and says, look, there's a black woman in space. So she felt compelled to work on The Next Generation, and she made sure she was part of it when this second show is made in the 80s, in the late 80s. And her role in this episode is more or less her role throughout the entire show, although we can talk more about that maybe later, which is Picard gets into an issue, usually a moral conundrum, and he'll go and he'll talk to his friend Guinan, played by Whoopi Goldberg, and Guinan has some wisdom, some otherworldly wisdom that she can bestow and cuts through the issue and sort of saves the day. And that's cool and all. But when I was watching this and other episodes with Guinan, I am, as an adult, as an adult, I'm thinking about Spike Lee's critique of the magical Negro, which he says is a trope in American media, whereby you can have a sympathetic black person on screen, but they are not a protagonist. Their value is not the same value as everyone else. They have some earthy wisdom that the protagonist doesn't have.
Sort of like an oracle figure, almost.
Oracle. And exactly the Oracle when you think about The Matrix. She is exactly Spike Lee's magical Negro. So, I don't know. Is it problematic? Did you find it problematic in any way? Or am I reading too much into it, given this was, what, 1987 or 88, probably?
I mean, I love Guinan. She's my favourite character. And I did a quiz once on which Star Trek character it was, and it said I was Guinan. I was very happy with that.
Did you tailor your answers to get that outcome, though?
I'm very happy with that. I think she's just such a great character. But if we think about the portrayal of Guinan amongst all the other ethnic and racial dynamics that you've got going on in Star Trek Next Generation, it is problematic. And so it's not just black actors that are portrayed in that way. If you think about the way Native Americans are always brought in as the spiritual, historical, connected to the earth kind of people whenever they're needed in other episodes, it's so problematic. So so the way that they situate certain ethnicities in the past or almost beyond time or beyond history, it has all that colonial kind of trappings. And then it's very much a vision of the white future that is playing out on the screen. So I think it is. I mean, even the Klingon, think about Worf, Klingon, black, full of kind of emotion and again, all these historical rituals. It's really back to nature. But as a powerful black woman,
yeah,
Guinan has a special insight and knowledge that is, I think, sort of gives her a certain agency that is we don't often see on the screen. So I think you can look at it in a couple of ways, but yes, the racial stuff about Star Trek is really problematic.
Dan, Sarah, do you want to add anything?
I've got something I'm interested in. Nice. I was really interested in the way the episode is playing with this idea about objects and subjects all the time. And so in the court case drama, to kind of make the argument that Data is property, they have to, Riker has to turn him into an object and go, look, I can remove his arm. Now this is not a living thing. This is an arm. I've removed it. I can turn him off with a button. This is an object. And I'm kind of interested in the way that's all played out. But then, of course, that all gets turned on its head by Picard, who questions to what extent that boundary between object and subject can ever be really realised. And then one of the bits that I find most interesting, and this is red alert, is the bit where it's revealed that Data had a sexual relationship with one of the female members of the crew. And this also just reminds me of a lot of queer and trans work that has been written about, you know, whether the biocock whether the biocock is the real cock or whether actually the machine could be an equivalent and whether we can play with those ideas. And I think all of that is going on in the episode, this playing with object and subject, and it's never fully resolved. And I found that really interesting.
In that scene, Picard, I think knowingly, brings out a portrait of the character Tasha Yar, who had Data describes he was intimate with. Did Picard know? Does he keep tabs on his crew and, like, who's getting funky?
I don't know, and everybody's really shocked. Like, the shock in the room, they're all like, oh my God, they had sex? It's really... But also, why is Data ashamed and embarrassed to admit it? He doesn't feel that. I know it's because he told Tasha he would keep it a secret.
Exactly.
And Picard says that Tasha would understand in the circumstances, it would be okay for you to share this. Mm. But...
Yeah.
I really like that scene, but I also enjoy the shock because I think the whole way that attitudes about sex on Star Trek is a whole other issue to be discussed.
It reminds me of that wonderful episode where was it Captain's Holiday, where he goes on holiday with the statue that Riker tricks him into having, which is meant to symbolise his sort of sexual openness and willingness to get down and. But he doesn't understand. That's what it means. So there's women keep approaching him while he's trying to have his holiday. And he's just, I just want to read my book. Why do I keep getting accosted by beautiful women?
Yeah, Fires very kindly bought me a T-shirt with that very same statue on it for my birthday. So thank you, Fires.
It says, looking for Jam Haran for anyone who encounters Dan in the street.
I think someone should talk about the fact that Data is fully functional. Because remember, that comes up in other episodes, doesn't it? As a man, he's fully functional.
That is in First Contact in the film.
Yeah. They make a joke out of it, like, I'm fully functional. And it's interesting because he's coded masculine, so we assume he has a penis. But do we know that? No, we don't know that. We don't know what they were doing.
Oh, I think we do. When we meet his mother in a later episode, she talks about how he made everyone else on the colony blush by running around naked and showing his little wang. Something like this. Yeah.
Did she say that? I can't remember.
I think, though, that one of the... So speaking of First Contact, I think one of the ways in which the show kind of undermines that a little bit is he's got a bit of skin that's grafted onto him, like actual human flesh, and it's plugged into him in such a way that he can... feel things, and you get the scene with sort of the Borg Queen blows on that, and it makes the little hairs on the skin kind of stick up, and that part, like, you could look at that is the show saying, like, this is authentic feelings or sexual feelings compared to what Data had before, which was a simulation or something incomplete.
Yeah, absolutely. And that boundary is constantly being played with. It's constantly unstable. Because when Data is talking about his positronic brain and the fact that even though they could download his memories into a computer, the essence of those experiences would be lost. We're not quite sure what that means because, as far as we're concerned, this is Data before he has an emotion chip. So he can't have an emotional response. So what is it that he's talking about? So they're constantly, absolutely playing between he's human, he's not human, he's machine, but he's also got this ineffable quality and experience that we can't, our words and our like discourses can't capture. So yes, so absolutely.
I think he's also, like, Data could well be asexual and that should be legitimate, but it's seen as being part of his credentials that he has been intimate with Tasha Yar. Data displays affection quite a lot of different ways, including with Spot the cat, who incidentally changes gender at one point, goes from being a man, a male kitten, and gives birth to kittens later on. but he's also affectionate with Geordi and other members of the crew and bonds over like certain topics. That should probably be sufficient, but this seems to be one of those things that helps kind of push him over the line.
I really like that, and I think somewhere we need to get in how it ends, because we talk when Picard does his speech and he's like shouting, like, I don't know what he is, doesn't he? And you know, when it's like, what is he? He says, what is he to everyone? Do you know? Do you know? And he goes around, he's like, I don't know.
It essentially like reflects Starfleet's own kind of way of doing things and way of seeing itself. Like, Data can only be understood on Starfleet's terms as being a full human, as in someone that Starfleet can recognise as a human. There's no real attempt to say perhaps we need to change these or rethink how we're going about that. It's just about how can we try to kind of extend these rights to cover somebody else rather than reformulate these rights. So the last like thing that I wanted to kind of discuss is about this character of Maddox, who seems to be like quite an obsessive personality type. He sort of doesn't seem to be able to let go this kind of initial evaluation he did of Data. It feels like he's got like some kind of unfinished business there. He very pointedly keeps referring to Data as it, rather than as he, which is how Data identifies. And then later at the final party, he refers to Data as a he. And that's seen as the acceptance that he has of Data as being a full person. I found that quite interesting. It seems like a very possessive person, that kind of colonial mentality of you're mine to do with, as I will. And I think that one of the things that he kind of tapped into, so one of the themes that we're going to be discussing across this series is this kind of tension or transition from ideas of liberal utopia to dystopia. But for me, Maddox represents a kind of more utilitarian streak within Starfleet, and utilitarianism, which is a doctrine that's been around in different forms, but is most associated with early 1800s Industrial Revolution incarnation. It's very much based around outcomes or consequences, collective good over individual good, and maximizing collective goods, which is often presented as maximizing happiness. And whereas Starfleet is often presented as a kind of culture based on kind of rights and individual rights, Maddox seems to be having a very different conception of that. And I feel this episode is quite effective at putting the two, either exposing that tension between the two or putting them on a bit of a collision course.
I think that's great. He accuses definitely Picard and maybe others of being emotional and irrational sort of multiple times, like they're speaking from their passions and he's the only rational one here. And again, that reminds me of sort of colonial discourse about to justify control or objectification of other human beings based on their rationality or perceived lack of rationality. And then at one point he says, rights, I'm sick of hearing about rights, which does strike me, like you, Dan, is very odd in the context of the Federation, our, you know, protagonist faction in the show, which is meant to be all about rights. That's like, you know, we're presenting this episode at the beginning of a discussion around liberal utopia and what is liberalism, if not a concept of rights. So what's going on there? Why is he, how can he be so dismissive of that, you think?
Well, I think to me, one of the concerns there is how much power an individual like that can accumulate in this supposedly rights-governed system, mm-hmm. because you would think someone might have intervened at some point and said, whoa, like, steady on now. We at least get some kind of ethical approval before you do what you want to embark upon.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. As researchers there, I think that's something we can all see is missing from Maddox's proposal. He did not go through a ethical approval board before he started his fieldwork. We'll now move on to talk a little bit about how the episode might help us analyze the world today. And to help us do that, I will start us off by talking about the comments given by other researchers at the University of Sussex, where last year I ran a Star Trek and IR seminar series. Postgraduate researcher Imogen Morley, Dr. Ida Danowid, and Dr. David Waring joined me to discuss this episode exactly. And they had some things to say about contemporary relevance and the analysis of world politics. Imogen said that the way in which the show, this episode, talks about certain populations as maybe being inferior or disposable, which is part of the narrative, the story that Guinan sort of gives to Picard about what would happen in a world where our mad scientist Maddox gets his way and is able to create a disposable army of Datas. And Imogen was saying that this had resonances to her with the way in which migrant lives are talked about in the UK, especially where migrant lives are deemed disposable in order to protect the British state, and their disposability justifies the violence done to them. So maybe we can pick up on that. Ida said that this showed the limits of radical politics. The only way to raise these issues was through liberal ideas of rights and sort of liberal functions like the court, which also struck me as odd. I didn't mention it earlier, but at no point does Data think about running away. Like, that wasn't an option. He's either going to submit to this awful experiment or he's going to win his court case. There was no third option, which I found strange in a life or death situation, as did Ida.
Yeah, and no violence or self-defense.
David had mentioned that, as we've begun to talk about, I think, that Maddox, our scientist character, is presented here as a sort of the cold Enlightenment thinker. And in doing so, he's defining who is and is not human. And this had parallels with teaching that he was doing on Locke at the time. John Locke, Enlightenment thinker, also does similar things in his description of Native Americans, where he can define or create a concept of humanity that excludes them, and in their exclusion justify genocide and expropriation of land, etc., which is very much what Maddox is doing. So those are some thoughts from some colleagues at Sussex. Is there anything there that we want to run with in trying to make the episode speak to or analyze the world today?
So I guess like the first one is Maddox seems to be on a quest for kind of self-improvement, not just kind of his personal advancement and recognition, but also seeming to want to improve Starfleet through issuing kind of Commander Datas or duplicates of him to other starships. But there's no consideration of what the effects of doing this would be in terms of how might this actually negatively influence Starfleet, like not just on an ethical level, which is one of the things that will be a recurring theme, but I think also in terms of what are the consequences of gradually transforming functions that are normally done by humans to androids. So it touches on something that I think the character of Guinan raises. She alludes to kind of slavery as being an effect. But what happens to human beings when they don't have to do tasks? We don't necessarily know what the answer to that would be, but that's not even considered there. It's just assumed to be a natural kind of good, and nobody challenges that. So the other theme I think that this kind of speaks to. So when Sarah was mentioning like this poker game, though, where you've got like this sort of distinction between the kind of the rules and regulations of the game and the actual way it functions, I think that was quite an interesting analogy on the part of the writers. One of the things that I find is recurrent within Star Trek is that at times it can kind of look like a cult of regulation, where they're constantly invoking regulations that. Regulation XYZ to help justify their action or inaction in certain circumstances. It's never really clear who writes these regulations, whether they can be changed or any of that kind of thing. And I find it to be, I guess, a bit uncritical because, and this is how it applies to a lot of real world examples. So an organization can create lots of rules and regulations that aren't necessarily for the benefit of people who will be impacted by those rules and regulations, but they might be for quite esoteric bureaucratic reasons that don't necessarily make a lot of sense to other people or might even be actively harmful to those people. And regulations are not really neutral things because they can also emerge to justify or excuse how an organization functions or to reflect its organizational culture.
That brings me to the point I think that Ida had mentioned in the seminar last year about the limits of radical politics, right? The inability to think outside of that bureaucracy almost cost Data his life. And that is something that we see change in the show. In later seasons, they do start to disregard the rules a bit more in the name of justice, in the name of passion, in the name of other things. Tradition, in certainly in Worf's case. But at this point, and this maybe preempts what we're going to discuss later, at this point, there was no discussion. I mean, we've talked about it. I mean, I raised it before, but I wonder what you think about. There was no discussion of civil disobedience, of the self-defense or anything like that. And I don't know, in contemporary politics, when we can witness a genocide live on our television and yet discussion remains around, well, should we or should we not legalize or illegalize arms sales? It seems somehow inadequate. I don't know. Just as this real world response to genocide seems equally inadequate as Data's response to potentially being disassembled.
Well, yeah, and I think with this case as well, like you would think there would be a broader public conversation in a liberal democracy about the kind of rights that are instead being discussed in this episode in a remote space station. It's kind of singled out as being remote. It's near the neutral zone. The JAG doesn't have a proper staff. She says she's sort of been out of Starfleet because she felt she was forced out and then she's kind of come back in. These aren't really ideal circumstances to be holding this type of discussion.
In that Enlightenment colonial mentality, it all works, right? Because rationality is abstract and not based so much on procedure or rigorous debate. Like an enlightened liberal individual simply knows the rules and can sit in their little space station in the middle of nowhere, think about law and arrive at a conclusion Kantian style. And so I think that fits within the world of Star Trek, which positions humanity as this enlightened, I don't know, species that it could become, as opposed to contemporary humanity in the 21st century, where we're still governed by our passions and are unable to do something as trivial as have three people in a room and decide once and for all the status of life for the poor Data.
Yeah. I suppose for me, the episode is really about, it's just fundamentally a political question, isn't it? How do we recognize you? How are you recognized? How are you recognized as a self? And what counts? And in whose political community are you in? And how we will administer that? So the whole thing is just the root of what all political and international organization is actually fundamentally about, those kind of relationships between self and other. And actually the way that it's contingent, those relationships and your status is contingent. So in that sense, especially the way that it kind of reflects Data, it really shows the limits of an idea of human rights as some sort of universal sort of God-given thing. Because actually we can see the contingency of that, and we can see that playing out in, I would argue, we can see that playing out in our world all the time in all sorts of different ways where people, you know, we don't all have the same rights or privileges. That much is very clear. And it's all about the recognition. And that's why arguments, for example, around whether Gaza is a genocide or not, or, you know, because all these things are contingent. So the episode shows its own failure.
Okay, so I think this reminds me of the Shamima Begum case, where, for those who don't know, this is a lady who at the age of 15, relocated to or slash was trafficked, depending on who you ask, to ISIS-controlled Syria, where she gave birth to several children who sadly died, as I understand it, and was stripped of her citizenship in the UK, and has been going through a lengthy process and various appeals to try to get her citizenship restored. And it's become kind of like a line that the state won't cross, that like you've renounced your citizenship, you can't be allowed back in. To me, this is, I see some kind of similarities with this kind of, like, okay, in this case it's citizenship rather than life.
But I think the Shamima Begum case is a really good example of this. The state is bestowing this recognition. It's contested, right? It's not something that is given. And I mean, that's just one example among many that we could think of, where actually the relationship between self and other is just completely contingent. And so that's why, Star Trek's interesting that way, because on the one hand, it's a liberal utopia with rights and freedoms, but then on the other hand, that it always is playing with the limits of that and showing how these don't work.
And the show itself wants to talk about slavery, right? That's becomes the motif of sort of the last third or last quarter of the episode, when they realize that, oh, what Picard says and Guinan says to him is that we're talking about slavery. Does that hold up? Because we didn't bring that up, even though the episode's making it really explicit, but we've gone to other points, both us here and during the seminar discussion last term. What do we think about that? Is the slavery analogy maybe a bit naive of the show, and there's actually more and more interesting things going on when we think about this contingent humanity, shall we say, and the way in which what they're showing is not abnormal or irregular. This is how liberalism functions in defining who is in, who is out, therefore who violence can be conducted on, and who can gain from these lives that are now considered disposable.
I think part of the difficulty there is the slavery analogy doesn't really carry to a post-scarcity society like the Federation, where none of the crew are getting paid, as I understand it. Like I suspect it's more there as a kind of signal, like anti-slavery is a liberal virtue, and that's why we want to. And that's why we want to avoid replicating something like that, because I think it does break down that trying to integrate notions of slavery into a society that's not really compatible with that.
I think slavery is, like you say, this liberal kind of icon of kind of enlightenment thinking and like the abolition of slavery, and it's set up as a binary between rights bearing humans or slaves. And so they bring up this side of, you know, this like horror of slavery to make the point. But actually, in many ways, it misses the point because that binary doesn't exist, actually. It's a series of gradations. And actually, even within the so-called rights-based kind of utopia, liberal utopia that we live in, those kind of rights are still contingent. So...
No, I couldn't agree more. The Dominic Lacerdo has a book called Liberalism, A Counter-History, and in it he points out that the rise of the transatlantic slave trade did not grow as liberalism declined. It grows as liberalism grows. They're not mutually incompatible.
Yeah, they're not opposites.
Exactly. Staunch liberals at home could justify slavery abroad precisely because they defined the slaves as non-human. And liberalism is all well and good if you're human or have humanity being a concept of rationality, being, you know, la 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 la. But these, you know, these West Africans, they're governed by their passions, they're not rational, therefore they're not human, therefore we can treat them as property. Very much a liberal line of argument. In our last segment of the show, we'll think about this broader theme that we're discussing over the season, shall we say, about liberal utopia as it's represented in Star Trek The Next Generation. What have we learned then today in this episode about the utopia of the show? Just to make clear, you know, Star Trek is presented in its early forms, let's say in the 60s and certainly in this show, The Next Generation, as a future in which humanity has overcome its differences. There is no conflict on Earth. There is no poverty on Earth. There is no natural disaster, famine. We have overcome everything through this acceptance of liberal humanist values. And now we're ready to explore the stars and sort of bring this enlightenment to the rest of the galaxy. So it is explicitly utopian in this way. And we have kind of hinted at some of its limitations. And Sarah's mentioned how what she finds most fascinating about the show is the fact that it plays on the limits and the boundaries of that utopia. But for this episode then, what do we think we've learned about utopia in Star Trek?
Well, one of the, for me, I think, so thinking about this theme of like liberalism, utopia and dystopia, the vibe I got from this show was actually quite dystopic. And I think like part of it is that the show is about somebody being taken apart and disassembled and whether they should or not be, whether that should or should not happen. Like, to me, you've got a problem when you've got to that level, right? In the court case, Commander Riker actually, with Data's consent, pulls out his arm from his socket and uses it as a piece of evidence, like an exhibit. I don't know if that should be happening. I don't know. Like, for me, it seems like potentially what we've got going on here is like a dystopia that's oblivious to itself, like does not quite understand that it's let things get this this bad.
Well, it's more, I mean, I also agree with that. And I read it through Picard, because on the one hand, sometimes Picard is like this total ideologue, like he's really into Starfleet. You know, and in other episodes, when he realizes Riker was involved in a mutiny at one time, like he's so shocked. He's like, a mutiny in Starfleet? Like, how could this ever happen? And because it's this universe where people don't, you know, we don't do that. We've evolved past that because we have rules and regulations. But on the other hand, he's also, in this episode, very frustrated and skeptical about the law and regulations, because he thinks it's about the spirit of the law. Like, we should be, it's the spirit of the law, not the actual kind of nitty-gritty in the details that would be allow us to disassemble Data. And I think, so it's almost about the idea, they acknowledge in this episode that the liberal utopia is a fantasy. Like, it's a fantasy. And they're always trying to kind of reach up to it, but they don't quite ever make it. And I think Picard's acknowledging that in that episode when he's talking about this distinction between the regulations and the spirit of the law, which is this greater thing. And he has all this faith in it. He really has faith that's this is the thing, but it's a fantasy. It's a complete fantasy. It's a fantasy utopia.
We are starting with one of the famous Picard speeches. And you're right, Sarah, he'll do this a lot, where he will talk to the audience, essentially, and tell them how great Starfleet is, or the Federation is, and talk about rights and talk about the spirit of the law. But yeah, the spirit of it, in actuality, it is this bureaucratic nightmare that Dan was discussing. But the dream, the utopia, even within the show, is this spirit of things which Picard always sort of reaches for.
Although sometimes it triumphs. Sometimes it does. So in this episode, it does. And then, I don't know, other ones like Drumhead, which I think we'll be talking about in a future episode, it does. But there are also episodes where it doesn't.
Yeah.
So
I feel like one of the most, well, perhaps not the most disturbing, but a disturbing thing here was that basically Data was told, you're going to have to resign from Starfleet if you don't want to be disassembled, which wasn't really fair. He's essentially being coerced into losing his job, and then he resigns and they're like, actually, we're going to do it anyway.
Although I don't know if that's the most disturbing thing, I think maybe the most disturbing thing is the fact that in the 24th century they use lunchboxes as luggage. I think Sarah's quite taken by the depiction of poor old Data packing away his things into a tiny
round.
What is it, Sarah?
It's also a tiny round capsule, which is totally impractical for lots of items which are rectangles. And I was like, why? Why is this the utopian vision? The like plastic little lunchbox that you can carry around with your things in.
And the concept of things itself is already questionable, right, Dan?
Well, yeah, I think with lunch, like, you just go to the corner enter what you want in the replicator and it'll come out. And you could probably even do that with many of your treasured possessions. You could just recycle them in and out of that, and it would make moving much less of a
It's really unclear how much of their stuff they actually move around with them, because they have all these weird tokens. Like Picard has all these historic books, doesn't he, that he likes to, he always likes to read an actual book. So they have these things, but they're fetishized objects that they carry around, because most of everything else can just be replicated. Like, you can replicate anything you want.
That's it for today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please join us next time when we look at the episode Q Who, and we will be looking at the Federation's first encounter with their most implacable foe, the Borg. And we're going to discuss concepts again of neoliberalism. I think we'll go into more detail on that, and questions of communism, capitalism, and what it is the Borg represents. Why are they so terrifying for our protagonists? Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fires.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Intergalactic Relations. This podcast is made possible by the International Relations Department at the University of Sussex. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes.